Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today, we're going to explore the economic history of the Afrin region in Syria. We're focusing specifically on the time before 2010.
Right, before the major upheavals began.
Exactly. And for this, we've looked at quite a range of sources. We've got academic papers, regional studies, reports from governments and NGOs, journalistic accounts, too.
Yeah, and across languages. English, Arabic, Turkish, Kurdish. Gives a pretty broad view.
Our aim really is to get a handle on the economic foundations of Afrin back then, you know, before the Syrian civil war caused so much disruption.
It's crucial context, really, for understanding everything that happened later.
Totally. So we'll be looking at the key economic sectors, infrastructure, land ownership patterns, state policies, and, you know, the general socioeconomic picture.
That's good. Where should we start?
Okay, let's dive in, starting with the sort of the deeper historical context, maybe pre-1960s.
Absolutely. If we go way back, late Ottoman period, say up until around 1918, maybe 1923, Afrin was actually part of the Kilis province.
Okay.
And what's really interesting is, even then, it was known as the Sancak of the Kurds.
Really? Sancak of the Kurds.
Yeah. And it was already a major olive growing area. The economy was overwhelmingly agricultural, centered on these, you know, huge olive groves.
Wow.
And Afrin town itself, it sort of emerged as a market center, a souk, back in the 19th century, driven by all that olive surplus.
So that identity, Sancak of the Kurds and the olive connection, it goes way back then. That reliance on one main thing, olives, seems baked in early on.
It does. That specialization definitely has deep roots.
Then comes the French Mandate period, right? Uh-huh. Roughly 1923 to 46. How did things shift then compared to the Ottoman times?
Well, that was a pretty significant transition. Afrin became part of French-administered Syria, so it got detached from Kilis administratively.
Right.
The French authorities, they did do some urban planning in Afrin town. They developed the main square into what became the central bus station, which is interesting.
Okay, so some modernization efforts.
Yeah, and the Baghdad railway station at Katma, which is built around 1912, connecting Aleppo and Anatolia, that kept operating. It was still important.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the biggest change, the really fundamental one, was the drawing of the Syria-Turkey border in 1923.
Ah, the border.
Yeah, that wasn't just, you know, a line on a map. It fundamentally reshaped Afrin's economy. It cut off those long-standing ties with Kilis and forced Afrin to reorient its trade towards Aleppo and other Syrian markets.
That must have been a huge shock economically, severing those traditional routes.
It really was. A lasting impact, no doubt.
Okay, so then Syria gains independence. What about that early post-independence time, say the 40s, 50s, into the 60s? What did that look like for Afrin?
Right. So Afrin was formally incorporated into Syria in 1961. And we see the population of Afrin town growing quite a bit then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from maybe 800 people in 1929 to around 7,000 by 1968. Quite a jump.
That is significant growth.
Nationally, there was this trend where profits from agricultural exports were often funneled into agro-industrial ventures. Things like, you know, processing plants.
Like olive presses.
Exactly. But the benefits weren't always spread evenly, especially in rural areas where land tenure could be tricky.
Okay.
Which raises a key question for Afrin. How much did the Kurdish population there actually benefit from these national trends, especially under the state policies that came later?
That's a really important point. Did the wealth trickle down?
It's likely that agriculture, especially olives, just kept dominating. But yeah, the distribution of wealth, the opportunities, that's something we need to keep in mind.
Definitely. Okay, so let's move into the key economic sectors just before 2010. It sounds like agriculture was, without a doubt, the big one.
Oh, absolutely. The backbone. Employed most of the population.
And within agriculture, olives, olives, olives.
Pretty much. Olive cultivation was historically huge. We're talking estimates of like 13 to 15 million olive trees before 2010.
15 million, that's staggering.
It is. To give you some context, around 2007, that was maybe 20% of Syria's total olive trees.
Wow.
And some of these trees were ancient, centuries old. It really shows how deep-rooted this olive monoculture was.
Centuries-old trees, that speaks volumes. But such specialization, it makes the region vulnerable too, doesn't it?
Definitely. Very sensitive to anything affecting olives, disease, prices, weather.
So what kind of olives were they? Anything special about them that made the region stand out?
Yeah, there were several local varieties they focused on. Sorani is one that comes up a lot in the sources.
Sorani.
Yeah, research suggests it had, you know, bigger fruit, better oil quality, a high oil ratio, like 25%, low acidity, good peroxide value. all things that made the oil more valuable.
Ah, quality factors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Crucial for things like the Aleppo soap industry. Other varieties were Haluni and Kalkali.
Okay.
And Afrin's olive oil, it had a reputation regionally for its quality. Sometimes people apparently called it Kurdish oil, known for sweet taste, nice aroma.
Kurdish oil. That's fascinating, like a regional brand almost.
Yeah, a point of identity, it seems. And they tended to use traditional, often organic farming methods. Harvest season was typically mid-October to the end of the year.
Okay, so millions of high-quality trees recognized oil. It makes sense that olive oil production itself would be a massive industry there.
For sure. By 2007, the sources mention around 285 olive presses in Afrin, mostly modern mechanical ones, so significant local processing capacity.
285 presses, that's quite a lot.
It is. And olive oil wasn't just processed locally. It was a primary income source for many families, and as we mentioned, a key raw material for the big soap industry down in Aleppo.
Right, Aleppo soap. Famous stuff.
And Syria as a whole was a major global olive oil producer before 2011. Afrin was a huge part of that. Nationally, the sector was a noticeable chunk of GDP, employed hundreds of thousands of households.
So olives were clearly the star, but was it only olives? Did they grow anything else?
No, no. There was definitely some diversification. Farmers also grew things like wheat, barley, lentils, cotton, sugar beets. Oh. Also citrus fruits, apricots, almonds, pistachios, various vegetables. There was even a push, apparently, to increase wheat production just before 2010.
Interesting. So trying to maybe reduce reliance on olives a bit.
Perhaps. And different sub-districts, places like Raho, Jindyre's, Bulbul, they apparently had their own localized specializations too, some focusing more on grains, others cotton or fruit trees, alongside the olives.
So a bit more complex than just olives then, but still heavily dependent. What about environmental factors? We hear a lot about that big drought in Syria.
Ah, yes. That's crucial. Syria went through a really severe drought from about 2006 to 2010. Some call it one of the worst in modern history.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
Now, we don't have super specific data just for Afrin in these sources, but given its heavy reliance on rain-fed agriculture, especially those millions of olive trees.
It must have hit them hard.
Exactly. And its general dependence on water resources. It would have been highly vulnerable. We could pretty safely infer the drought led to lower yields, serious water stress. Mm-hmm. And this could have been made even worse by any national policy changes around agricultural support during that time. It would have really squeezed livelihoods.
Yeah, a major blow to an already specialized economy. Okay, let's shift gears slightly. What about industry and traditional crafts beyond the farm gate? Sounds like it was more limited compared to agriculture.
That's generally right. Industrial activity was mostly tied back to agriculture.
Mm.
Olive oil pressing, as we said, was the main thing, those 285 mills.
Right.
And Afrin was the key supplier for Aleppo's soap makers.
Right.
But what's interesting is some sources hint that maybe, even before 2010, there were some very early steps towards localizing parts of the soap value chain in Afrin.
Oh, really? Like actually making some soap there?
Maybe not full production on a large scale, but perhaps some initial processing or related activities closer to the oil source. It's not super detailed, but suggestive.
Interesting potential there. What about other industries? Textiles were mentioned somewhere.
Yes. Textiles come up as a local industry in Afrin City before 2011. But we need to be careful here. The huge boom in textile workshops that happened after 2011, that was really different, tied to displacement from Aleppo.
Ah, okay. So pre-2010, it was smaller scale.
Likely much smaller scale. Probably small workshops, maybe handicraft weaving, tailoring, mostly just serving local needs, not the industrial level seen later.
Got it. And other traditional Syrian crafts, pottery, metalwork, that kind of thing.
You know, Syria has this incredibly rich tradition of crafts, but our sources don't give much detail about their economic weight in Afrin, specifically before 2010.
So maybe present, but not major economic drivers.
Probably present on a small scale, yeah. But the economic energy, the focus, seems very much centered on olives and related activities.
Okay, so agriculture and its immediate spinoffs dominated. Let's talk trade and commerce then, tied closely to the agricultural output, I imagine, especially with Aleppo.
Exactly right. Afrin town, remember, started as a market back in the 19th century. It remained the main commercial and administrative hub for the whole district.
The central souk.
Yeah. And that area near the Katma train station also showed market activity, highlighting that transport link. But the really crucial connection was with Aleppo.
For the olive oil, primarily.
Primarily, yes. Supplying the soap industry, other food markets, Aleppo. The Baghdad Railway was historically important, but by this pre-2010 period, roads were probably the dominant mode for trade.
Makes sense. Now, Afrin's geography is interesting, almost totally surrounded by the Syria-Turkey border. Did that mean much cross-border trade before 2010?
That's a key point. Historically, back in Ottoman times, ties with places like Kilis, just across the border in modern Turkey, were strong.
Right.
But that border creation in 1923, as we discussed, really severed those formal ties and reoriented Afrin inwards towards Aleppo and Syria.
So the border wasn't a big trade gateway then?
The sources suggest there wasn't significant formal cross-border trade directly involving Afrin right before 2010. Now, informal exchange, smuggling, that might have happened, as it often does in border zones. But formal trade was limited. The border acted more like an economic wall for Afrin at this time.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about the infrastructure needed to support all this. What kind of development did Afrin see before 2010? Transportation, water.
There was gradual development over time. You had that early important piece, the Baghdad Railway and Katma Station, built around 1912. Mm-hmm. Crucial for trade, passengers, even military logistics back then.
Right, the railway.
Then later, under the French, we saw the main square in Afrin town become a central bus station. That highlights the growing importance of roads.
Mm-hmm.
Aleppo Governorate generally had decent road connectivity, so we can assume there were primary roads linking Afrin town to its sub-districts and, critically, to Aleppo for all that commerce and administration.
So, rail early on, then increasingly roads. What about water management? That seems vital given the agriculture and the later drought.
Hugely important. The big project here was Medanek Lake, created by the April 17th dam.
Medanek Lake.
It was started in 1984, finished around 2000. It dammed the Afrin River. The main goals were, one, boost agriculture through irrigation, and two, promote some domestic tourism.
Did the tourism part work?
Apparently, yes. By around 2010, the lake was attracting thousands of visitors each year. It supported local businesses, restaurants, cafes, maybe some small resorts. So it was an effort to both help farming and diversify the local economy a bit, provide more water security.
Sounds like a really significant project for the region then, trying to buffer against that rain dependence. Any other major industrial infrastructure besides the olive presses?
There was some development, particularly in the 80s and 90s,
yeah.
But again, mainly focused on olive processing, lots of commercial places, workshops.
Okay.
One source, interestingly, suggests some of this development actually got financial support from the PKK.
Oh, really? That's notable. A non-state actor influencing infrastructure.
It is. Adds another layer to the economic picture.
Definitely. And what about just basic utilities? Electricity, water, sewage. How is Afrin doing?
Again, specific data for Afrin District is a bit scarce in these sources, but looking at Aleppo Governorate overall,
mm-hmm.
access was pretty high by 2011.
High?
Yeah, like electricity access was near 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Major cities had good sewage networks. Improved drinking water sources reached about 90% of the population.
So pretty good coverage, then.
It seems so. It's likely Afrin, particularly Afrin Town, benefited from these general trends. Though you always have to wonder about disparities between the town and the more rural villages, right?
Yep.
Consistency of service, quality.
True. That urban-rural divide is common. Okay, this next area feels particularly important and potentially sensitive. Land tenure, ownership, and state policies before 2010, especially given Afrin's Kurdish identity.
It's absolutely central, yes. As we've said, Afrin was overwhelmingly Kurdish, maybe 90% of the population, and land ownership was largely Kurdish, deeply tied to their farming traditions, their history, their identity.
Right, you mentioned Kurdot.
Exactly. Mountain the Kurds. Land wasn't just an economic thing. It was core to culture, passed down through generations. Really fundamental.
So against that background of Kurdish land ownership and identity, how did Syrian state policies play out? We hear terms like Arabization. That sounds like it would have economic consequences.
Oh, definitely. Sources describe heavy-handed Arabization policies aimed at promoting Arab nationalism over Kurdish identity.
What did that involve, specifically?
Things like banning the Kurdish language in schools, suppressing cultural activities, changing Kurdish village names to Arabic ones.
Wow.
And sometimes even transferring Arab families onto land owned by Kurds. Plus, there were specific laws, Decree 49 in 2008, for instance, aimed to evict people from border areas.
Which would disproportionately hit Kurds in Afrin.
Precisely. And it piled onto existing laws that already made it hard for Kurds to buy, sell, or even formally inherit land. So these policies weren't just social or cultural. They directly attacked the economic security and potential of the Kurdish population by creating instability around their main asset.
It sounds incredibly challenging. Creating deep insecurity around the very basis of their livelihood. Were there other restrictions on property rights, too?
Yes, Kurdish residents, especially in those border zones, faced a lot of red tape, difficulty getting official land deeds to the tapu, problems getting permits for building or even just preparing houses on their own land.
Bureaucratic hurdles.
Yeah, and Syria's whole land registration system was notoriously complex, often incomplete, and bureaucratic anyway. These issues were often worse for Kurds in Afrin due to, well, discriminatory application of the rules.
So even if you technically owned the land.
Right. The lack of secure deeds, the restrictions on building or improving your property, it hampered any long-term investment. It created what economists sometimes call dead capital.
Dead capital?
Yeah. Assets like land that you can't easily use for economic activity, can't borrow against, because the property rights are insecure or legally tangled up. It really stifles economic dynamism.
So the policies effectively locked up potential economic activity and investment. What about the bigger picture of national land laws in Syria?
Well, technically, Syrian law said natural resources belong to the state. Private land ownership was protected, but it was subject to the state taking it for public interest, supposedly with fair compensation.
Supposedly.
Exactly. Inheritance followed Sharia law. There were also land reforms going back to 1958 meant to redistribute land. But how exactly they impacted Afrin isn't super clear in our sources.
Okay.
The main point, though, is that even where national laws existed, they could be applied in a discriminatory way when it came to ethnic or political factors. This added another layer of insecurity for Kurds in Afrin regarding their land.
So what were real tension between local Kurdish ownership and traditions and state control, often used in ways that disadvantaged them? What about agricultural cooperatives? Did they play any role?
They did exist in Syria before 2011, and they potentially played a role in Afrin. They could have helped farmers with things like insurance, maybe access to loans, seeds, fertilizer, that kind of thing, supporting the olive sector.
Could they have pushed back against some of those state policies?
Well, their effectiveness and independence might have been limited by state influence. Given the broader political context, it's questionable how much autonomy they had to really advocate strongly for the specific needs of Kurdish farmers facing those discriminatory policies.
Right, likely constrained. Okay, let's pull back a bit and look at the overall socioeconomic conditions.
Yeah.
What was life like for the people in Afrin before 2010?
Well, demographically, as we said, overwhelmingly Kurdish majority, about 90%. But there were smaller communities too, Arabs, Yazidis, Alevis, some Christians, so some diversity.
And Afrin town itself was growing.
Yeah, quite a bit from the 60s onwards. People moving in from the surrounding villages, probably looking for work, maybe better access to schools or services.
And employment, still mostly farming.
Hugely dominated by agriculture. Mm-hmm. Maybe 75% of the population employed in farming right before 2011.
Wow, three quarters.
Yeah. So non-farm jobs were mostly in Afrin town shops, small workshops, maybe some government administration jobs, services. But there wasn't much diversification outside agriculture overall.
Which makes the whole population really vulnerable to farming shocks, like that drought.
Exactly. Very vulnerable.
How did those bigger national economic trends we talked about, liberalization, inflation, the drought, how did they actually impact people's daily lives in Afrin?
Well, Syria saw some economic growth in the 90s and 2000s, but those liberalization policies didn't benefit everyone equally. They could have actually hurt vulnerable rural populations like those in Afrin.
How so?
Changes in national farm subsidies, for example, would hit Afrin's farmers directly. High inflation, like in 2008, eats away purchasing power, makes everything more expensive.
Right.
That investment law number 10 was supposed to encourage investment, but did much of that actually reach a peripheral, predominantly Kurdish region like Afrin, especially with all the land tenure issues? Probably not much.
Seems unlikely.
And then, of course, that massive 2006-2010 drought just put incredible stress on the main source of income for most people. Reduced incomes, maybe food shortages.
Mm.
Plus, Syria's financial sector wasn't very developed, meaning it was hard for small farmers or businesses in Afrin to get credit to invest or just tide them over during hard times.
So national events and policies had very real, often negative local consequences piling onto existing problems. What about just basic services and living standards? You mentioned utilities were generally okay at the governorate level.
Yeah, Aleppo governorate had relatively high access to electricity, water, and basic school enrollment was high too. But, and this is a big but, Aleppo governor was also considered the poorest in Syria back in the early 2000s.
The poorest. despite Aleppo City.
Yeah, with really significant rural poverty. So even though Afrin had fertile land and all those olives, its largely rural population likely faced considerable economic hardship and lower living standards. Mm. Those discriminatory policies we discussed didn't help, and neither did the agricultural shocks. Household incomes were typically modest. Official unemployment stats might not have looked terrible, but they could easily hide a lot of underemployment in farming people working, but not earning enough.
A tough picture overall, despite the agricultural wealth.
Definitely. Potential constrained by policy and vulnerability.
Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Always welcome.
Sniffs. Mmm, smells good today. Mm. Let's see. Takes a sip. Oh, it's actually really good today, Hannah. Nicely balanced, not too bitter. Perfect amount of sugar, I think.
Excellent news. Takes a sip. Ah, yes. Very good. Thank you, Hannah.
Delicious. Okay. Takes another sip. Right. Where were we before that lovely chai break? We were just summarizing the socioeconomic situation.
Yes. Basically highlighting that despite access to some basic services, the combination of rural poverty prevalent in the governorate, the specific vulnerabilities of an agriculture-dependent economy, and those discriminatory state policies likely meant significant economic hardship for many people in Afrin before 2010.
Got it. So let's try and bring all these threads together now. Yeah. Thinking about Afrin's economy before 2010, what's the main takeaway? What's the big picture here?
I think the key insight is that Afrin's pre-2010 economy was absolutely fundamentally agricultural. Mm. Olives weren't just the main crop. They were deeply woven into the region's Kurdish identity.
Right. More than just economics.
Exactly. And while the region clearly had significant agricultural potential and saw some development in infrastructure like the dam and roads, its progress was really held back.
By what, mainly?
Primarily by those discriminatory state policies that created so much insecurity, especially around land, and limited opportunities for the Kurdish majority. And second, by its vulnerability to environmental shocks like the drought, because of its reliance on rain-fed farming, and vulnerability to national economic shifts and policies that didn't always benefit peripheral regions.
So it paints a picture of, like, potential under pressure. An economy with promise facing these really significant constraints from both policy and circumstance.
That's a good way to put it, potential under pressure.
And this whole historical context, yeah. The olive specialization, the infrastructure that was built, those deep socio-political grievances related to identity and land, the specific demographics, it really does set the stage for understanding the incredibly dramatic changes that happened after 2011.
Absolutely. You can't understand the post-2011 events without grasping this pre-existing reality. And that connection you mentioned between the people, their land, and the olive trees, that remains such a powerful, enduring part of the region's identity and likely its future, whatever that holds.
Yeah. The pre-2010 period really shows us an economy with considerable promise facing these serious limitations. It highlights that complex dance between local potential and these bigger external forces of political, economic, environmental.
It really does. A complex interplay.
It leaves you wondering, doesn't it? What other factors, perhaps ones we haven't touched on as much, might have significantly shaped Afrin's economic path if the conflict hadn't happened and if those discriminatory policies hadn't been in place? It's certainly something to think about. Thanks for walking us through all that detail.
My pleasure. It's a complex but important history to understand.